Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, October 26th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline today is a commentary. It is entitled, Conservancy Passionate About Area. Numbers Show Hogan Park Project is Investment in Midland. By Jeff Beard and Mark Dingler and Chris Ginsback and Christina Lee Johnson, members of the Quality of Place Board of Directors. The Quality of Place Conservancy is a 501c3 nonprofit organization made up of volunteers who have a passion for Midland and the Permian Basin. The Conservancy was formed to enhance public parks through a public-private partnership to protect taxpayers and help the city of Midland. QOP stems from Morales' 2019 leadership. QOP gets its roots from Priority Midland, which was started under the mayoral term of Jerry Morales. The purpose of Priority Midland was to bring together all vested parties, from taxing entities and corporate partners to foundations and residents wishing to pour their time into Midland. All while pursuing the same goal, to make this fast-growing and changing city a shining light, not only for the Permian Basin, but for the state, nation, and global stage. One area of focus for Priority Midland was quality of place. It was in this committee where volunteer residents coalesced around the mission of improving the planned and built environment in Midland by incorporating innovative design, cohesive architecture, connectivity, and quality pedestrian spaces was formed. Hogan Park is first QOP project. COVID delivered a major blow to Priority Midland, but it did not deter the resolve of the QOP committee. During this time, it was discovered that a Hogan Park project was already underway, and the QOP committee of volunteers could come alongside the city and potentially raise private dollars to help turn the park into a first-class park focused on the community. The City of Midland graciously allowed the QOP committee to review the plans for Hogan and suggest design edits and to dream big and pivot the initial city-planned $10 million redo into an epicenter for outdoor recreational life for all Midlanders and visitors to our great city to enjoy and to be paid for mostly with private dollars. In partnership with the city and the design firm hired by the city, QOP added core design elements that include pavilions, food truck lanes, event lawns, innovative play, covered basketball courts, and walking paths, as well as future elements that would be sequenced in as additional funding is made available, such as sand volleyball courts, extended walking trails, additional play turf lawns. With generous donations from Abel Hanger Foundation and Scarborough Foundation and other private donations, a feasibility study on raising money was conducted for this new vision for Hogan Park, and the findings were overwhelming that the QOP Hogan Park initiative would be supported through private dollars by the community. Before the Conservancy was formed, the city had already budgeted the $10 million for Hogan Park. City accounting does not track maintenance and operations from park to park. They just budget for the entire city. To approximate Hogan Park costs, we must make educated assumptions. The city manages 1,172 acres of parks, and their 2022 parks budget looks to be $6.86 million. So, if we take the QOP portion of Hogan's acreage of 128, that equates to 10.9% of total parks budget, meaning the city currently spends approximately $747,740 on current Hogan's maintenance and operations. Volunteers raise private funds. The Perryman Group conducted an economic feasibility study to provide vested parties insight and confidence that an investment into Hogan Park would benefit all Midland residents, not just those that may utilize the facilities. The study not only considered direct revenues from the facility rentals, but the overall economic impact of spending at our shops, restaurants, and hotels. Hogan Park is hoping to be the first of many projects that QOP would take on in order to achieve their mission of improving the quality of life for Midlanders. Project won't increase property taxes. Unfortunately, in the last several days, this project has become a political talking point in the current election cycle. The Hogan Park plans are still a work in progress, and, as with any project, there are always a wide array of variables, and currently, numbers are not finalized. Projected cost, $55 million. Raised through private donations, $28.5 million. City investment, $10 million. Annual revenue sources, city support, continued private donations, facility rentals, sponsorships, sports banner sales, tournament ticketing, and parking. The QOP is working hard to raise the additional $45 million from our generous community. As of the writing of this article, we have raised just more than $38.5 million, including the city's $10 million. Conservancy launches extensive public awareness campaign. The campaign has been very clear about cost, sources of revenue, and benefits to residents. Multiple articles, television presentations, forums, radio talk shows, and social media platforms have showcased the unique benefits of this public-private partnership. We have tried to push out information as soon as it becomes available. Because of election season, the QOP decided to not do its regular press releases in October and November. But due to the recent articles, we thought it important to respond. Contract for annual maintenance not finalized. The City of Midland proposed to QOP that it would set aside $2 million a year to help with the maintenance and operations of Hogan Park. This is typical, as the city did something similar with Centennial Park downtown and committed up to $500,000 per year toward maintenance and operations at Centennial. Centennial Park is 3.5 acres, Hogan Park is 128 acres, and hopes to create a similar atmosphere and become a hub for community activity. Pools numbers incorrect. Conversations with the city are ongoing with the lease agreement for the parkland to be managed by QOP. Nothing is finalized, but the initial figure offered by city staff was $2 million annually. QOP doesn't read the agreement that payments escalate year over year by the full CPI number, as Councilwoman Robin Poole used for her article. QOP interprets the draft agreement to be the percentage increase, if any, between prior and future year. We do agree that spending $550 million for a park is too much and would not support that type of arrangement. As a reminder, Hogan Park was scheduled to be renovated by the city before QOP was even in existence. The city was already committing the same dollars to construction and would continue to maintain the park over the next 65 years, with the same economic factors at play. Poole makes no reference to $17 million in annual revenue. While no study can accurately predict actual revenue, the Perryman Report estimates $17 million in annual revenue from Hogan's tourism and revenue sources. This comes from residents and visitors to our area who will get out more and pay to shop, stay, and eat in our community. Let's be conservative and cut that $17 million in half and call it $8.5 million. The city's current 2022 budget spends approximately $747,740 for Hogan's maintenance. And if the city does the QOP agreement, that will add $1,252,260 over current budget for the city to gain conservatively an additional $8.5 million in revenue. Goal is to reduce strain on taxpayers, enhance Midland, support city. We realize that the city's funds are limited, and we don't take the budget lightly. We are fellow taxpayers and are fiscally responsible. We have worked hard to garner private donations and have in fact become donors ourselves. We see this project as an investment in our community and for future generations. We hope that you will also see the value of this project and stand by us. As volunteers committed to making this great city of ours even better, we welcome any questions and discussions on how we can continue to partner with all vested parties to find unique and creative solutions for this place we all call home. This article is entitled, Council Hears Details on New Downtown District. Initial cost estimate of entertainment area by city staff in presentation is $838,000. By Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council got a first peek into what a downtown entertainment district could look like, including $838,000 in capital expenses and yearly operational expenses of $514,977. The entertainment district is being looked at to help bring more life to the downtown area and complement the Bush Convention Center, Centennial Park, and other businesses that already exist. The entertainment district concept is not set in stone. The City Council is looking at information at this time. The concept presented to them by city staff on Tuesday before the regularly scheduled meeting shows an area that surrounds Centennial Park and the Bush Convention Center. The boundaries are generally Illinois Avenue to the north, Big Spring Street to the west, Baird Street to the east, and Missouri Street to the south. Included in the Entertainment District overlay map are the DoubleTree Hilton Midland Plaza, Basin PBS, Wall Street Bar and Grill, Cancun Grill, Pi Social, the Micro Market along Wall Street, and the Yucca Theater, which is home to Summer Mummers. City staff told the council that area is smaller than what some might have liked, but is also, quote, more manageable, unquote. The presentation also included a slide about new land uses, including interactive art, outdoor restaurants, pop-up shops, and parklets, which are sidewalk extensions that provides more space and amenities for people using the street. The creation of an entertainment district would allow those existing businesses, like bars, nightclubs, restaurants, distilleries, and lounges, and those wanting to bring events downtown, like festivals, to not apply for specific use designations. City leaders heard about key design elements like alley improvements, increased lighting, signage, inviting street furniture, landscaping, and bollards, which are used to create a perimeter around an area. They also heard about street redesign opportunities like curbless streets, clearly striped pedestrian crosswalks, reduced speed limits, narrow lane widths, wider sidewalks, trees, and lighting that illuminates all walking spaces. One part of the presentation also included the possible redesign of Texas Avenue from Big Spring East to Main Street. One such option included the reduction of travel lanes. Similar changes were made years ago to Wall Street east of Big Spring. City staff added that estimated expenses of the entertainment district initially could be $838,000, which includes $750,000 for Texas Avenue reconstructions, $70,000 for permanent bollards for Wall Street, $20,000 for signage, $20,000 for trash receptacles, and $48,000 for maintenance vehicles. The $514,977 in yearly operational expenses included $100,000 for insurance, $156,000 for security, $86,546 for maintenance personnel, $79,917 for a parking enforcement officer, and $92,514 for a downtown coordinator. There haven't been decisions on revenue streams or whether businesses inside the entertainment zone will be assessed to help pay for the improvements. This article is entitled West Texas Natural Gas Prices Go Negative for First Time in 2 Years. Seasonal pipeline maintenance is worsening existing constraints on the region's network of gas conduits as mild weather curbs consumption. America's gas output surged to a record this year as global supply disruptions buoy prices of the heating and power plant fuel and boost demand for U.S. exports. Much of the gain was driven by Texas, which has long enjoyed some of the lowest energy prices in the country, thanks to its vast oil and natural gas reserves. Politicians there have used the shale boom to brag about the state's low taxes, unemployment rates, and fuel costs. Even Europe, starved of the Russian imports it has long needed, has replenished its stockpiles. But the risk of a winter gas crisis remains for countries on both sides of the Atlantic. U.S. regulators have warned of shortages in the Northeast, a region that relies on gas from overseas to make it through the coldest months. In the U.S., regulators limit how much gas producers can burn off in a process known as flaring, which releases carbon dioxide. That's contributing to the Permian supply glut, according to Paul Phillips, a senior strategist at risk management firm Uplift Energy Strategy in Denver. A crackdown on flaring, both from regulators as well as self-imposed by some of the companies themselves, has forced the spot market to go negative, as sellers desperately look for outlets for their gas, Phillips said. Permian prices will probably remain under pressure through the end of the week until pipeline maintenance is completed, according to Jason Ferguson, an analyst at analysis firm RBN Energy LLC. Meanwhile, U.S. benchmark natural gas futures surged Tuesday amid speculation that a recent sell-off has run its course. Contracts for the heating and power generation fuel delivered at the Henry Hub in Louisiana, which is not directly affected by pipeline constraints in Texas, have fallen for 9 straight weeks, the longest losing streak in 3 decades. This article is called Halloween Events. Editor's note: more adult-friendly events taking place this weekend will appear in Thursday's edition. Adult-friendly Halloween events. Head over to Tall City Brewing Company for a post-work pumpkin patch and painting sesh. The Manuana Brothers, who TCBC partnered with this summer for their Agua Fresca line, will sell their farm-grown gourds. Art supplies will be available. Festivities begin at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday at 3303 West Golf Course Road. Rooster's Backyard will host a vintage pumpkin paint night with hopeful designs and boutique. Patrons will be provided with the necessary utensils needed and can ensure a grand evening of pumpkin-focused door-hanging art. To reserve a seat, send $40 and the painting date to HDB owner Tiffany Phillips via Venmo at Tiffany-Phillips or Cash App $Tiffany. Brushes hit canvases at 7 p.m., 6221 Farm to Market 307. Fall Festivals, Trunk or Treats, Country Fairs. Episcopal Church of Holy Trinity, Trunk or Treat, 5:30 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, 1501 Ohio Street. All donated canned goods will be donated to the Jubilee Center of Midland. Halloween Fest, 6 to 8 p.m., Thursday, MLK Park, 2300 Butternut Lane. Trunk or Treat, 5 to 7 p.m. Saturday, the Orchard Church, 6112 North Highway 349. Midland County Sheriff's Office, Halloween event, 5 p.m. Saturday, Big Sky Drive-In Movie Theater, 6200 West Highway 80. Midland Bible Church Country Fair, 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday, 5900 Whitman. Trunk or Treat, 5 p.m. Sunday, 409 Veterans Air Park Lane. Trunk or Treat, 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday, Wilshire Baptist Church, 801 South Bentwood Drive. Any additions to Halloween events should be sent to sdoreen@hearstnp.com. This article is entitled Midland County Early Voting Locations for November 8th Election. Midland County Elections Office, 2110 North A Street, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. today through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. October 29th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. October 30th, and 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. October 31st to November 4th. Centennial Library Meeting Room Number 113, 2503 West Loop 250 North. 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. October 29th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. October 30th, and 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. October 31st to November 4th. Cogdill Learning Center, Classroom Number 4, 201 West Florida Avenue, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. October 29th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. October 30th, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. October 31st to November 4th. Fairmont Park Church of Christ, 3813 North Midland Drive, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. October 29th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. October 30th, and 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. October 31st to November 4th. St. Paul United Methodist Church, Abundant Life Center, 4501 Thomason Drive, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. October 29th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. October 30th, and 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. October 31st to November 4th. This information is provided by the Midland County Elections Office. This article is called Business in Brief by Ben Schaffer. Report: Self-employment in Odessa among highest in nation. There are a total of 10,187 self-employed workers in the Midland metro area, or 11.4% of the workforce. In the U.S., 10.2% of the workforce is self-employed, a self-financial report stated. The small metro area with the most self-employed professionals is Santa Fe, New Mexico, whose workforce is 18.8% self-employed. Odessa is seventh on the list of U.S. small metro areas with a workforce that is 15.1% self-employed. According to the report, self-employment nationwide had been on the steady decline since 2004 until the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic. Shutdowns caused businesses to close their doors and let go of employees. 22 million workers lost their jobs in the spring of 2020, the report says. The self-employment rate in spring 2020 rose to 10.5%. In 2021, more people began quitting their jobs to seek new ones or start their own business, which kept the self-employment rate steady, according to the report. Report: Electrical engineer in Midland among lowest in U.S. Midland is the third worst paying small metro area for electrical engineers in the U.S., a Porch.com report states. According to the report, the median annual wage for electrical engineers in Midland is $76,762. Nationally, the median average is $100,420. College Station Bryan, Midland, Lubbock, and Tyler are among the 10 of the worst-paying small metro areas for electrical engineers, the report shows. The highest-paying small metro area for the profession is Idaho Falls, Idaho, which has a median average of $142,404. There are no Texas cities among the 10 highest-paying small metros, the study shows. Texas is ranked 31st for median annual wage for electrical engineers. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled, "Big Oil's Profit Poses Awkward Problem," by William Mathis and Kevin Crowley, Bloomberg. Big Oil's run of record profit will suffer only a minor dent for the third quarter, even as the global economy shows signs of cracking under the pressure of rising inflation and interest rates. Indications of the slowdown will be evident across their sprawling businesses, from lower crude prices to slumping chemical margins. Yet, the five oil supermajors are still poised to report the second highest earnings since their formation in the early 2000s, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. A modest decline in earnings after record profits earlier this year won't be enough to take the industry out of the political crosshairs. As governments around the world grapple with the cost of energy today and the need to transition to cleaner alternatives in the future, the risk of state intervention remains. "It's definitely awkward," said Abhi Rajendran, adjunct research scholar at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. "These companies won't want to be beating their chest over strong business results that are coming at the expense of consumers and a difficult economic environment." ExxonMobil Corporation, Chevron Corporation, Shell PLC, Total Energies SE, and BP PLC will report combined earnings of $50.7 billion in the third quarter, down from the second quarter's record of more than $62 billion, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. It's a slightly weaker environment than last quarter, but in the context of the last 10 to 15 years, the results will be extremely strong, said Biraj Bukhataria, an analyst at RBC Capital Markets. As the wider economy slows, the oil and gas industry is one of the few areas where earnings are going to be resilient. Gas versus chemicals. Preliminary third-quarter figures released by Shell and Exxon give an indication of which parts of the industry are up and which are down. The Texas oil giant said earlier this month that earnings from refining and chemicals will be lower. Morgan Stanley expects Exxon's refined products and chemical earnings to drop about 35% from the second quarter, says the weakness will be replicated by others. The banks see Chevron's downstream earnings 45% below the prior 3 months. It was a similar picture from Shell, which reported a decline in refining and a negative margin of $27 per metric ton from chemicals. That reflects a broader economic slowdown, particularly in Europe, as high natural gas prices force some industries to curtail production. "Chemicals are closely intertwined with the economy," said Columbia's Rajendran, who is also director of research and advisory at Energy Intelligence. "It says something about the health of the economy." On the flip side, analysts revised up their earnings estimates from natural gas after Exxon's trading statement, which showed the company benefiting from higher prices in the period, offsetting the decline in crude. This is good news for shareholders, but could add to political pressure on the companies. The UK already slapped a windfall tax on oil and gas producers earlier this year, and the European Union proposed its own levy in September. Shell Chief Executive Officer Ben Van Beurden, who retires at the end of the year, said recently that energy companies would need to pay more tax to help governments shield their poorest people from energy bills. In the U.S., President Joe Biden last week called on energy companies to plow their gains into fresh production rather than giving more cash to shareholders. You should not be using your profits to buy back stock or for dividends, he said at the White House. Not now. Not while a war is raging. It's unlikely that Exxon and Chevron will accede to Biden's request, although they may not continue with the repeated dividend and buyback hikes seen over the past year, according to Paul Cheng, a New York-based analyst at Scotiabank. The U.S. giants are likely very comfortable with their recently increased buybacks, each worth about $15 billion a year, he said. The European majors are more likely to accelerate shareholder returns, according to Cheng. In the past, the oil majors have indeed invested in new production during boom times, but those high spending decisions have too often come back to bite them when prices declined. Even before Russia's invasion of Ukraine triggered the current energy crisis, companies were also under pressure to curb spending on fossil fuels and pivot to low-carbon technologies, rather than spend their cash on costly mega-projects. With record profits this year, companies are still showing spending restraint, said Oswald Clint, an analyst at Sanford C. Bernstein Limited. We should always be careful to say this time is different. But certainly, it smells different this time, he said. This article is entitled, IEA Can Tap Huge Oil Reserves If Supply Is Disrupted, by Shoko Oda, Bloomberg. The head of the International Energy Agency said its members have oil reserves available to conduct another round of releases if needed. We still have huge amount of stocks to be released in case we see supply disruptions, Fatih Birol, executive director of the Paris-based advisor, said in a group interview at the Singapore International Energy Week conference. Currently, it is not on the agenda, but it can come any time. The, quote, unfortunate, unquote, decision by OPEC Plus to trim production at a meeting this month threatens the outlook for prices, just as economies around the world are on the brink of recession, Birol said Tuesday. IEA members earlier this year released fuel following a surge in prices, which have slipped about 30% since mid-June. Separately, the world is not at all out of the woods in terms of natural gas supply after a recent softening in prices due to unusually mild temperatures in Europe, Birol said. European countries may have to refill their inventories for the winter of 2023 without Russian gas, while an economic rebound in China could further tighten the market for liquefied natural gas, he said. The IEA is also revising its expectations for renewable energy installations upward, as governments, especially in Europe, take steps to accelerate the transition away from Russian fuel, Birol said. Renewable energy capacity may increase 20% this year, with almost 400 gigawatts of new capacity added, he said. This article is entitled, Saudi Energy Minister Warns Against Depleting Crude Buffers, by Salma El-Wardani, Zainab Fata, and Grant Smith, Bloomberg. Saudi Arabia's energy minister defended OPEC Plus's contentious decision to cut production, while criticizing major importers for trying to tame prices by selling down their inventories. People are depleting their emergency stocks and using it as a mechanism to manipulate markets, Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman said at the Future Investment Initiative conference in Riyadh. Losing emergency stocks may become painful in the months to come. Last week, President Joe Biden announced another release of barrels from U.S. reserves, adding to the hundreds of millions already sold by rich countries in recent months, after OPEC Plus agreed a surprisingly large output cut. The Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its partners, a 23-nation alliance led by the Saudis and Russia, irked the White House by opting to slash output by 2 million barrels a day at a meeting on October 5th. U.S. officials said it came at, quote, the worst possible moment, unquote, given global inflationary pressures, and Biden said there would be consequences for Saudi Arabia. Prince Abdulaziz said the OPEC Plus move was justified by a weak economic outlook and the need to preserve spare buffers. There are layers and layers of uncertainty when it comes to both supply and demand, and a gloomier outlook for the next year, the prince said. The best course of action was for OPEC Plus to mitigate that uncertainty, he said. I think we, as Saudi Arabia, decided to be the maturer guys, he said. Brent crude is up 21% this year to around $94 a barrel, though it's dropped from more than $120 in June. That's largely due to economic slowdowns in Europe and the U.S., and Chinese demand being hit by the country's zero-COVID strategy of strict lockdowns. This month's leadership congress in the world's biggest crude importer reconfirmed that China will continue with its policy, which means the much-talked-about potential growth will be still waiting to happen, Prince Abdulaziz said. At the same time, potential supply shortages loom from early December, when the European Union is set to ban seaborne imports of Russian oil as punishment for Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. The bloc is also proposing to stop its insurers and banks providing services to any buyers of Russian crude globally. Riyadh is engaged with a number of European governments, including Germany and Poland, to ensure security of supplies this winter, the minister said. Saudi Arabia supplied the continent with 950,000 barrels a day of oil in September, roughly double the level provided a year ago, he said. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, October 26th. Peggy Lou Strong. Peggy Lou Strong, 70, of Midland, passed away on October 22nd. Graveside services will be held Friday, October 28th at 11 a.m. at Rest Haven Cemetery. Peggy was born on October 16, 1952, to Mary Lou and Dalton Mitchell in Amarillo. She is survived by her son Tony Strong and wife Letitia and children Reven, Gage, and Rush of Midland, daughter Catherine Hardaway and husband Miles, and children Dalton and Travis. She is preceded in death by her husband, Ronald Strong, father Dalton Mitchell, mother Mary Lou Mitchell, and sister Charlotte Brown. The family suggests memorials be donated to the Alzheimer's Association. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. James Vernon Scoggins. James Vernon Scoggins, 81, of Midland, passed away October 19th. A memorial service will be held on Thursday, October 27th, at 10 a.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net. May Cougar. May Cougar, 81, of Midland, passed away on October 21st. Services are pending with Andrews Corgill Funeral Home.
This is Thoris with Odessa American News for Wednesday, October the 26th. Trial begins in sexual assault of a child. The editor's note says the story contains graphic descriptions of child sexual abuse. Jurors in the trial of an Odessa man accused of sodomizing and raping a 5-year-old girl heard testimony Tuesday. There was some physical evidence to back up the child's claim. Tuesday was the first day in Dakota Lee Hoyt's trial on 3 counts of aggravated sexual assault of a child, a first-degree felony that is punishable by 5 to 99 years of life in prison. Assistant Ector County District Attorneys Melissa Rain and William Frashner represent the state, and Scott Lay is defending Hoyt. The 30-year-old was indicted in October 2021 after family members reported the suspected abuse. A forensic interview was conducted and a physical exam was performed by a sexual assault nurse examiner. Martha Banda, the registered nurse who examined the child at Medical Center Hospital, told jurors she saw no trauma when she examined the child's vagina area. However, she did observe abnormalities when she examined the child's rectum. Jurors also heard from Arcele Aurelio, a former forensic interviewer at Harmony Home, who has been trained to ask non-leading questions of sexual assault victims and who has performed over 530 such interviews. Aurelio said the child's first statement to her was, "Hoyt, quote, does nasty stuff. He puts his privates in my face, in my private parts, and in my butt," unquote. The girl told her the acts happened, quote, a lot, unquote, and they hurt her and made her want to cry. Aurelio said, she also said that when Hoyt, quote, peed, unquote, in her mouth, it tasted disgusting. The little girl further told her Hoyt had taken pictures of her privates, Aureliano said. Under cross-examination from Layla, Aureliano acknowledged the child used the same words in the same sequence every time she spoke about the acts. She also testified no pornographic pictures of the girl were found on his phone. She also agreed the girl seemed, quote, happy and playful, unquote, throughout their time together and recalled how, after telling a family member what had happened, the family member gave her candy. Aurelano also acknowledged the child's siblings told her in separate interviews the child lies a lot. Under redirect, Aurelano told Rain, it's normal for five-year-olds to be playful even during such interviews, and most are unaware of things like sexual abuse. She also told the prosecutor she suspected the siblings had been coached prior to the interview because they both said their sister was, quote, lying, unquote, on Hoyt and trying to make him go to jail. In addition, even though the child made the unlikely claim, some of the acts took place while Hoyt was playing a game on his phone involving Martians and soldiers. The girls also described times when Hoyt wanted her to tell him what he was doing felt good, and she refused because it did not. The first witness to take the stand was a family member who told jurors she was bathing the child when she noticed the child's hiney was red. When she asked her about it, the child told her Hoyt had put his privates in her butt, the woman testified. The woman told a family member, and it was that family member who called the authorities, she said. The entire family has since moved out of state, she said. Under cross-examination from Lay, the woman insisted any confusion about dates of events could be attributed to her age. She testified the child told her about the abuse during the first week of July, but Lay said the evidence will show the abuse wasn't reported until July the 21st. She also insisted the children were never left alone with a family friend who was a registered sex offender. The woman had to be repeatedly reminded by Judge John Schrode of the 358th Ector County District Court to stop interrupting the attorneys during their questioning and for repeatedly making comments beyond what was asked of her. She also laughed when Ray objected to some of Lay's questions and Schrode sustained the objections. After the final interruption, Schrode asked her if she understood his instructions, and she replied yes. It's yes, sir, or yes, your honor. You don't want to interrupt me, Schrode said. After being excused from the witness stand, the witness loudly exclaimed, I don't want to look at him anymore anyway, when she was told she couldn't remain in the courtroom. The witness was referring to Hoyt, and during a conference at the bench, Schrode was overheard telling the prosecutors they need to have a talk with their witness. According to court documents, prosecutors have asked Schrode for permission to admit evidence during the trial that, while on the internet, Hoyt discussed sending photos and describing the manner in which he would sexually assault the girl and engaged in discussions about bestiality, incest, minor girls, and child pornography. Court records show Hoyt has an extensive criminal history, which includes one felony conviction and several misdemeanor convictions. UTPB, ready to host first STEAM Fest. As part of the American Chemical Society's Chemistry Week, University of Texas Permian Basin will host Steam Fest from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Sunday, October the 30th, in the Science and Technology Building foyer. It's also meant to be a way to promote the Science and Engineering Fair coming up in February. We're going to have two main events in the classrooms. We're going to have chemistry and science demos, so we're going to have demonstrations, explosions, and things like that, said Milka Montes, Associate Professor and Department Chair of Chemistry. Montes said the event is geared to children from 3rd through 12th grade for science fair. One room will have people talking about the upcoming science fair, what the requirements are, what students can do, how they can make it better, and more. We're going to have tables, and on those tables we're going to have people from all different disciplines of STEM, S-T-E-M, engineering, math, physics, chemistry, biology, geology. We're also going to have health sciences, people from sociology. Everybody's going to have some kind of demonstration on how we do science in our specific disciplines, Montes said. This is also to give the kids and their families, their parents, ideas on what they can do to research on. It's going to be a display of what the faculty and the students do here, but also a display of what real-life research situations are like. Associate Professor of Art Chris Stanley will have a new kiln outside to create art. It will be geared towards kids, to children and their families, to the communities, Monty said. They want anyone interested in science or STEAM to visit. It is the day before Halloween, so if they want to bring their costumes, they're welcome to. We're going to have the stations. Each table is going to be a station, and we're going to have bingo card or like a Mexican lotería. When the kids finish their round, then they get a treat. They're going to get a bag with swag, Monty said. The children will be able to build something and take it home. It's a community learning event, she said. It's the first big event prior to the Science and Engineering Fair because we're coming out of COVID. It's going to be the biggest event right after all of the being at home right before the science fair. We want people in the community in the Permian Basin to come and see what we have and give them ideas and have fun, Monty said. The Science and Engineering Fair will be in February, but they don't have an exact date yet. STEAM Fest will serve as an orientation for the fair. Don Bonifay, a local engineer who promotes the science fair, UTPB faculty, non-faculty people from Ector County, ISD, and community people will be on hand. It's a collective group, and we call ourselves the Permian Basin STEAM Coalition, Monty said. We're just people who love science and engineering, and we want our kids to learn about it. We want our community to be very well prepared because we are in the middle of oil and gas and technology, and our community needs to raise our kids knowing and being aware of science and technology and the fields that there are. But you cannot take away art because the creativity needs to be there too, so that we can come up with the solutions to the problems we have, Montes said. Task Force presents broadband funding request. Ector County ISD Superintendent Scott Murray asked the Ector County Commissioners for $1.2 million as part of the ConEctor Task Force's efforts to bring high-speed, affordable broadband to the area. Murray said 25% of that has to come from the local community. Commissioners listened, but no vote was taken. Murray said he and other task force members at the meeting Tuesday are seeking funding to establish a nonprofit 501c3 organization entitled the Conductor's Broadband Office. The office would be community-based and governed by a board made up of community members. One member of the broadband board will have engineering experience. Other members will come from the nonprofit community, utility providers, as well as local county governments, should the county provide funding for this effort. Once a board of directors is established, the board will hire an executive director to oversee the work for the next 3 years. This executive director position will be a full-time position charged with generating the dollars that will fund this, as well as the execution of this shovel-ready plan within our community. He added that there are some initial startup costs. The $1.2 million would be spent over 3 years to hire the executive director and do the work of the broadband office to bring high-speed broadband to our community. We will retain legal counsel in the establishment of this 501c3, and the work done by the executive director will have legal support. We will hire a coordinator to support the startup of this process. We will have a communications plan, so part of this expenditure will also be to communicate. One of the things we've learned during this process is that the education of our community is critically important. There are individuals and families and business that will need to understand the why. Why is broadband important to you? How would it affect your business? How does that affect your family, etc.? So some of this work will simply be educating our community in these opportunities, Murray said. We'll also provide technological support using these funds for the implementation of our plan, he added. He said they will also need technological assistance to fill out and complete the grant process as it is complex. We must demonstrate as a community that this investment is something that we want. It is something that we are committed to, and there are a variety of actions that we have to take locally in order to qualify for these federal dollars, Murray said. They would start identifying board members in November and form the Connector office. In December, they would establish charter, mission, and goals. They would also make a budget working with consultation of an attorney. At the end of December, early January, they would launch a search for an executive director, and during January and early February, they would hire the executive director, and January into February, they would begin the preparation and application process for the federal funds. Murray said they anticipate knowing better how much the state of Texas will receive in the new year. Gabby Rowe, who led Operation Connectivity Team for Texas during COVID, emphasized that this is a competitive process and $4 million is not anywhere close to the amount that the state needs to bring last-mile connectivity to every household in the state. It would take 5, 6, maybe even 10 times more, Rowe said. The preparation phase is 12 to 18 months long, and the building phase is about 12 months, she said. Along with the education around adoption of broadband, there also is a workforce development component, which means developing training courses for local citizens to become installation techs, maintenance techs, for connectivity, working with local higher education to develop that as sustainable programs in the community to create jobs, Rose said. The greater share of that is taking place in the community. The higher the point score with a competitive bid, Rose said. It's not just a win-win of bringing the connectivity and the economic development that goes with that, but also that comes with the workforce development and the digital skilling for the citizens, Rose said. The Texas Comptroller's Office and federal government will soon begin the process of awarding the funds. The federal government has set up a competitive grant process. But we anticipate in the state of Texas alone, we'll have access to $4 billion as a state. But those dollars will be distributed on a competitive basis. This will simply not be applied and received. There will be very stringent guidelines in place. It will be communities such as ours that currently we are one of four communities in our state of Texas that have assembled a cross-functional group of individuals that are focused on bringing high-speed broadband to its community, Murray added. He said it will be groups like the Connector Task Force and communities like this one that will have access to those dollars. When the infrastructure is built, it would be self-sustaining. The county would not have to subsidize it in perpetuity, Murray said. Not every community in Texas will receive these dollars. There will be winners and there will be losers, and it is our opportunity as a community to be a winner in this competitive grant process, Murray said. Only 16% of residents in rural areas have access to fixed high-speed broadband, Murray said. In West and South Odessa, nearly one in four individuals, families, have connected households. That's 23% report paying more than $100 per month when the national average for high-speed broadband in the home is $58, and that's in our county today. Broadband access is an economic driver in the state of Texas. One in five Ector County Independent School District students rarely or never have reliable internet access in their home. Students without reliable internet access are located all over our county, not in specific areas or pockets. This issue is all over Ector County, Murray said. About one in six households in West and South Odessa report having no internet connection. Most internet subscribing households in West and South Odessa, which would be 75%, are dissatisfied with the current internet service that is provided in their homes, and nearly every respondent to a survey that we conducted, 99% of families, are interested in more choices and options for the internet service providers that currently feed their home, Murray said. Commissioner Greg Simmons said broadband would be a benefit, but he still has questions. I'm still curious as to how the federal government is giving the money out, and I know that they have done it before. I still don't understand why private entities are not being able to do that. I understand the investment is high, but if the investment's coming from the federal government, Simmons said. Rose said the federal government has tried giving funds directly to private entities before, but it has not worked. County Judge Debbie Hayes wondered why existing government programs couldn't be used to help people pay for internet.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.